Hi, I'm Kevin Clark, Associate Editor for America Magazine. Welcome to AmericaMagazine.org and another in a series of our summer roundtable discussions of current events with our editors. Today, we are going to welcome Karen Sue Smith, who's our Editorial Director, and Editor-in-Chief Father Drew Christensen is here with us. And we're going to be talking about, I know something where probably everyone in the nation is discussing at some point or other, is the whole debt ceiling, deficit reduction, debt control debate that has been embroiling our political life. We'll also be talking about Christian and Muslim relations in America based on some new reports that have come out. Drew, was it from, Gallup?
Gallup has a service out of Abu Dhabi that's done a new study, but there's been several over the last few years.
So we'll be evaluating some of those reports, and we'll also be talking about the current events emerging out of the UK, anarchy in the UK, the disturbances in the streets in London, Manchester, and other major cities this week in England. But why don't we talk about this disturbance here in the United States for now, our ongoing problems with how we deal with our debt ceiling, our national debt, and maybe the way we talk about it and the way we discuss it among each other, not too well lately.
I wanted to bring up a particular piece, an op-ed article that was written by Erskine Bowles, who's a Democrat, and Alan Simpson, who's a Republican, and it was called A Crisis Merely Postponed, and it appeared right after the debt ceiling bill was finally signed
in the New York Times.
Yeah. The reason I'm big on this particular article, or there are a couple of reasons, but one is that while everyone else was trying to place blame and trying to pick winners and losers, who won in that debate? Was it the president? Was it the Republicans? Was it the Tea Party? These two people who have both bipartisanship and real gravity because of their earlier report, they wrote a report last year about this same subject, seized the moment and wrote this piece. And so instead of looking backward, my main point is that it looks forward, which is a really important thing for all Americans to do, to quit playing the blame game and look ahead. And the second thing is that it looked at a lot of long-term solutions. It said that this whole move that has been done was a start, and it didn't evaluate so much, but it said, of course, that now we still have to make all sorts of huge decisions, and they have to be made by this committee, this bipartisan committee that's going to be set up by November 23rd. And we all know what happens. If that doesn't, then there's this trigger that sets in. But what they're trying to say is that even that is just still a start, because what really has to happen is taking a look at these long-term solutions, enormous problems like tax reform, reform of entitlement programs, looking at the defense budget, all of this kind of stuff. And so they're urging for
the stuff
bipartisan.
They already looked at in their previous study.
Exactly. Yeah. And so they're trying to say, we didn't do all that in vain. We want to urge bipartisan compromise. We want a spirit of compromise. And this was the key. They wanted people who come to that committee and the American people to be bold.
Do you think that we're capable of being bold at this point?
Oh, I think we're capable of being bold. The question is, who's going to be bold first? Uh-huh. Who's going to quit playing chicken, so to speak, and go this completely other way and start imagining a great America again instead of a cowering America that's worried about its every dime and its every job? How are we going to get our shtick back?
Well, it seems what I find interesting about that article is neither Bowles or Simpson, I think they had the opportunity there to say, hey, we already did this work. Why is there yet another super committee being established? We've had the plan from the Gang of Six. Now we've had this plan from Erskine Bowles, and now we're waiting once again for another plan to emerge. Is it possible that we really don't want to hear about a plan because we're not going to like the, as the president said, to eat our peas?
Well, there's a lot of people saying that, why should another committee work? And, we've been playing kick the can politics for so long, let somebody else decide. But the pressures now are mounting and mounting, and especially with a European scene and people discussing whether there is or isn't going to be a second recession, or some people not even calling it the Great Recession anymore. They're calling it a financial crisis, which is bigger than any kind of recession, and it's ongoing. Mm-hmm. These pressures are different from what they were before.
Have you had a chance to look at the members of this new super committee?
As far as I know, only the Republicans have been chosen, and just three Democrats. So
yeah,
I
they're
think
waiting for Pelosi's
waiting,
picks.
Exactly. Right. They're waiting for three more Democrats. There's only one woman in the mix so far, if I'm not mistaken.
And she's Patty Murray, I believe, out of Washington, Patty Murray?
Yes, out of Washington.
Yeah, and she's being attacked for being too political, which I don't know how anyone out of Washington could be accused of being too political. But yeah, I looked at some of the composition of the committee, and it didn't give me a lot of hope that we were really going to see anything new come out of this, any resolution emerge from this committee, because you've got three hardcore, I believe, members of the Republican group who are already on the record who are just never going to support any sort of revenue alteration or tax increases towards controlling the deficit. Although I guess all they need is get one vote from the Republican side to move the report along.
That's right. Even among the Democrats, Max Baucus, for example, who has done a lot of work for the Democrats and has been doing a lot of moderating type work, he actually voted against the Erskine-Bowles earlier report that they gave in 2010.
Yeah.
But it's true. They only need one. And I think people have every reason to be serious. The only other thing that bodes well for it is this new trigger, which has two huge things in it that neither side wants: cuts in defense, automatic cuts in defense, and automatic cuts in entitlements. And these are huge cuts. They're going to a total something like $1.5 trillion. That might work, because once before, there was a trigger mechanism put in, and it actually did succeed.
Isn't it unfair to talk about entitlement reform? I mean, Social Security is safe for another 26, 27 years. It's a self-insurance program where people pay in and therefore should be getting something back, having paid in there at their lifetime of employment. It's not in any immediate danger. It's an ideological target. Whereas in the case of healthcare, you have an entitlement that keeps growing because we haven't found no way through the market to control healthcare expenses, particularly for technology and pharmaceuticals. And the government has forbidden, and reform has forbidden, negotiation by the government agencies like Medicare for lower prices. So, I mean, it seems to me that it's really unfair to include Social Security, but it's also unreasonable if you're not talking about cutting expenses for healthcare.
I'm so happy that you mentioned the healthcare. I can't believe I didn't mention it earlier, but that's one of the huge reforms, and it does include some reforms of Medicare and Medicaid right within it, and some waste. And I think that your point about, can the federal government get the same kind of negotiating deals that others get who buy in bulk, is a huge thing. And if Democrats were really smart, they would go back, because this is what Republicans do. They go back to their old knee-jerk things and stick them in when the pressure is really big. They would go back and say, look, here's a savings. Here's a huge savings. And present it as a savings and try to drum up a little support for a health care bill that they've been shying away from even admitting that they passed. But it was a very good thing. But it never did deal completely with this cost containment. But that is one way that it could get at it.
Yeah, it might be, if they could look at it this way, it might be more practical to try to isolate those two issues. For instance, as Drew pointed out, Social Security with small modifications can really be fixed without too much pain and suffering on anyone's side. I think it's good till 2036 right now.
Yeah.
Yes.
And with some tinkering, I might actually be able to get some Social Security when I retire. I'm looking forward to that someday. But as you say, if we could isolate that, it's kind of unfortunate that it is wrapped into this whole debt ceiling budget deficit control debate, because there's an easy fix there, and we may not even be able to get to that because we can't get to the comprehensive giant compromise that everybody's talking about. Whereas it could be a fairly easy fix for Social Security.
I think the Democrats would have to really come back on that one and allow only the smallest of fixes. I don't think that Social Security is above any kind of fix or reform. I think there could be very small things. It could be tuned up. And some people are speaking of things like having people who have higher incomes raising the ceiling where those people are still paying into Social Security. That's, I forget what the actual ceiling is right this moment. Do either of you know what it is?
Not off the top of my head.
But at a certain point, they feel that those people won't get the same, will never get the services out of it that they've paid in, and so they've lopped it off, so they don't have to pay after a certain amount that they've paid. They could lift that. That would be a reform, but mm-hmm. it's a small reform, and it wouldn't hurt anything. In fact, it would help things, and it would still be not means tested. Other ideas, though, have been to try to raise the age and other things like this that I don't think would be terrible if they were considered. I just think that Democrats will have to keep the lid on that. But it's the healthcare thing where all the money is. The healthcare costs keep rising, and that's what keeps threatening to sink the economy.
And it's kind of interesting. It's amazing, really, how many of our problems really circle the whole problem of providing healthcare in a decent and just way in the future. All the troubles with public sector unions now that we keep hearing about. What are they fighting about? They're fighting about health benefits more and more. Finding a way to keep coverage and keep decent coverage. And it's as Drew said, we've been talking about this for decades now, and we've never been able to come up with a plan that covers everyone and covers everyone sufficiently in a way that we can afford to pay for it.
Well, there's the little populist plan that's going around in some of these emails that you get, in which is one of the tenets of it is to have Congress have the same health plan that everybody else does and not give health plan for life to people who have served only a single term, and to raise that up or get rid of it completely.
So Congress would feel some of the same pain occasionally.
It's not just pain. They would share the same health program unless they wanted to buy. I mean, they would face the same problem, and so they'd be more empathetic. I think that's a very good idea. I don't know what you think.
I'm all for it. If they have to spend half the time negotiating with their health insurance bureaucrats as I do, they might have a whole different perspective on this this event, on this experience. Something else we need a new perspective on is the relationship between Christian and Muslim Americans and the status of Muslim Americans in the United States 10 years after 9/11. Drew, what can you distill for us from that report that you're writing about?
Well, the Pew
Center... This will be appearing in what issue of America
This
magazine?
Will be in the September 12th issue of
September 12th
America,
issue of America.
America's Muslims. It's a piece I've done with John Borelli of Georgetown, who was a former colleague at the Bishops Conference, where he did Muslim relations for the bishops, and he does interreligious affairs at Georgetown these days. The article was generated by a request from Choisir, which is a French-Swiss Jesuit journal, and they wanted something on American Muslims. And so we put our heads together and basically looked at what's available. And there's actually been a very concerted effort to kind of do social science survey research on American Muslims by the Pew Center and also by Gallup, out of different places, both in the United States and most recently out of the center in Doha, in Abu Dhabi. And that study was released only at the beginning of the month, in fact, almost as we were filing the article. And so the article has a lot of interpolations in it, where we say the latest study or the newest study says such and such. I think what's surprising, will be surprising for a lot of people, is that American Muslims are, in the language of the report, thriving, and they regard themselves as thriving in the United States. More than half have incomes over 50,000, and a large percentage over 100,000. They're heavily represented in the professions. A great number come from South Asia, from Indonesia, from India, Pakistan. They are well integrated into American society. Most say their closest friends are Americans of other races and ethnic backgrounds. They do regard the post 9/11 situation as being one in which they experience an undue amount of scrutiny and a certain degree of not persecution, but intolerance. The surveys on perceptions by other people of Muslims say that there is significant levels of intolerance towards Muslims. The real key here is the more ignorant a person is of Muslims, the more intolerant they will be.
That's shocking.
You know, and they don't conform to stereotypes. I mean, 70%, if I remember the figure correctly, believe that the situation of American women is good. On the other hand, they are worried that if Muslim women wear the hijab, they will be discriminated against, and that's a legitimate fear. And of course, during the last year, there's been lots of anti-Muslim activity and anti-mosque construction activity, especially here in New York around the so-called Ground Zero Mosque and Islamic Center in the border regions of the South, in Tennessee and in Iowa. There was another incident here where the Archdiocese was forced to, in New York, to
backpedal,
on a sale of a convent to a Muslim group for the building of a mosque on Staten Island. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, the mosque was in a neighborhood where a lot of families of survivors happened to dwell, so that is, survivors of first responders.
I guess the problem there would be that it would be hard to establish any sort of center for Islamic culture in New York area without being in some sort of neighborhood that was not hard hit by 9/11.
Well, I mean, there are mosques downtown within 10 blocks of the Ground Zero, so mm-hmm. it's not as if it's impossible. The original Imam Rauf, who was named as the spiritual leader for what was called the Cordoba House in the original proposal, he's led a congregation in downtown New York for a long time. So it's not but there is a fair amount of fear, and kind of in the case of the Ground Zero Mosque, a certain high level of xenophobia on the part of some of the victims' families, because there are other victims' groups that support the building of the mosque. So you can't say that.
Yeah, it seems the issue has been sort of taken up by people well beyond the victims' families. I mean,
that's
think of Pamela Geller and that whole crowd of people that are.
But on the whole, American Muslims feel welcome. They're doing well. They want to be here. And I think there are good signs in that the latest 2011 survey shows that younger Muslims who were more alienated are much more satisfied with American society today than they were the time of the last study.
And the interesting thing really about the study is how boring Muslim Americans are. I mean, they seem to be, you know, your typical suburban, most people reject violence, are horrified by terrorism,
right.
Happy in the United States, they're earning a decent living here. They seem to just want to assimilate in as much as their culture is acceptable of assimilation.
Yeah, the only place where you see signs of extremism, and that's been diminishing between the most recent survey and the previous ones, is among young converts.
Converts
do tend to be young. Largest number are between 19 and 21, and the next largest group between 19 and 35. So converts tend to be young. And among African-American Muslims. And among African-American Muslims, they are going to face discrimination, unemployment, and other problems in the U.S. in any case.
Yeah.
And so the resentment is less for being Muslim than it is for finding oneself black and belonging to the underclass. And it seems to me that those are problems that really have to be tackled on their own. And the latest survey is not helpful, and that it takes religious prejudice and racial prejudice and brings them together and says, have you experienced racial prejudice? And the result is confusing because you can't look at
the variables.
The variables, exactly. Yeah.
So do you think things like the Peter King Commission are going to help improve the attitude of American Muslims to their new homeland?
No, I don't think so. I think they have groups to adequately represent them on these issues, but it's interesting that they say that only about 10% feel that the national groups represent them, which is really, really interesting. I mean, the national groups everywhere have a great hearing in the U.S. at least, but as a matter of fact, they don't represent people. And it seems what I think that suggests is that Muslims want to see themselves more as a part of the American mainstream than a part of an Islamic subgroup within American society.
And it seems that American Muslims are not experiencing some of the same issues that are experienced by Muslims in the United Kingdom, for instance, the difficulty in social mobility, some of these restrictions regarding clothing that are coming up in Europe are really not even being discussed in the United States. Is that mentioned at all in these reports?
Well, what's the comparisons generally with the UK and Europe are on issues of extremism, and American Muslims have a much smaller fraction of their numbers oriented towards extremist political positions or think that suicide bombing is legitimate. In fact, an interesting piece is that American Christians, Catholics and Protestants and Mormons think at a far larger numbers, more than half, think that violence against civilians is sometimes legitimate, whereas most Muslims, by a vast majority, think that it's never legitimate.
Which is one of the more interesting outcomes of these reports.
I think that is.
If we can switch now to the ongoing violence in the United Kingdom that we've been seeing this week. Ironically, today is the anniversary of the 1965 Watts riots in the United States. We've seen these kind of eruptions, these urban eruptions in the United States from time to time. They've been actually much more violent in terms of injuries and deaths than what the United Kingdom has been experiencing. Despite all the headlines, there's been only, I think, 4 deaths that have emerged because of this disorder, and 3 of them were out of one incident where someone apparently ran over some men who were trying to protect a Muslim community in England. But, you know, in our urban uprisings, there have been significant numbers of deaths and injuries. Otherwise, there seems to be a lot of parallels between what's happened in the United States from time to time and what we've seen in England in the last few days. You have one incident that draws a lot of public outcry, begins peaceably. In our case here, we had the Rodney King incident when the trial was acquitted the police officers. Then we had a tremendous eruption of violence. In England's case, a young man, Mark Dugan, was killed by police under very obscure circumstances at this point. There was a peaceful protest that led to disorder that quickly spread throughout London and throughout the nation. It's a little hard to try and figure out why these kinds of things happen, because it seems as if the psychology of the mob has its own life. You know that there'll be reports. I'm sure there'll be people looking at this trying to come up with sociological explanations for why this event occurred. But in the final analysis, maybe the veneer of civilization really is particularly thin.
Well, I think what you have, it's common in both situations, is the alienation of some marginal groups from the society, which in Britain includes a large swath of young people of all races, not just immigrants, I think, which is important to understand. I think what distinguishes the current set of riots is that they're really, you know, outside of the initial protest, the rioting is not about a social cause, even though they, you know, there's jobs and there's an element of criticism of the government austerity measures, and particularly people look at the situation and say the lack of funding for scholarships for university and programs that have been available is one of the things you can look at as being behind this. But on the whole, it's not as if they parallel a social movement as the riots in the 60s did with the civil rights movement. It seems to be much more kind of the have-nots just rising up against the haves and saying, look, we can take what we want. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as the Archbishop of Canterbury said in the House of Lords this morning, you know, what we need is to have better education that integrates people into society and gives them teaches virtue. But it seems to me that the British experiment at open, more or less open immigration to the Commonwealth has not succeeded in integrating the poor into the society, nor, since the Thatcher era, have they integrated their own lower classes into the success of the society. Those are issues that may give us a view of where our own future is going because of the growing inequality here and the way the political system tends to ignore inequality as a social policy issue.
I wanted to make two observations about this. One is that for an unorganized, kind of spontaneous-like reaction or response, which is that what that was in London, it also spread, so to speak. It happened in other places, as far away as Manchester, for example. And so that's something very, very interesting, not just a copycat, but somewhat copycat, but it shows a kind of disgruntled feeling among young people around Britain, not just
yes,
in
some
in the
small
city.
Communities as well.
Yeah.
Their own disorders.
And then the second thing is that most of these young people have no jobs. It's not just that they may have educational limitations. They have no jobs either. They have nothing to occupy them. And as we look at our own unemployment growing and growing, and especially it's much, much higher in our country, too, among young people.
And in specific communities, urban communities.
Exactly. It's a bad thing for any society, and it breeds violence, I think, to have an underclass and an unemployed underclass and to have too many young people with absolutely nothing to do and little potential to have a job or a future.
And you throw in a spark like the Mark Dugan shooting, and then the realization, and here's another issue that came up, has been spoken of in England, is the cutbacks on security, on police, on coppers on the streets has been significant, I guess, under these new austerity budgets, and perhaps the quick realization among the mob that the police could not control, you know, this neighborhood, this, mm-hmm. you know, that everyone was locked into was not under anyone's control, and that they could easily take it over. Once that realization occurred, that's when the mob psychology took over, it seems. And
well, everyone's so concerned about budgets now that they don't want to spend any money for training programs or youth programs or whatever, but this is the other side of that. If you're not willing to occupy your young people and put them to some useful work, training them in some way or giving them some useful thing to do, don't be surprised if violence is what you end up reaping from that neglect.
I think that another dimension of this writing has been consumerist materialism. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's...
Everyone's going for the Nike running shoes and the flat screen TV.
That's right, but it's kind of luxury items, if you will, mm-hmm. And it's they're symbols of the division of the society that you don't have mass produced goods that and distribution systems to get goods to ordinary people, but everyone measures themselves by whether they have these luxury goods mm-hmm. that where business can make the biggest profit. And no one is thinking about what you can provide for ordinary people that will give them a sense of improvement in their lives. And on the other hand, if you don't have any other values than materialism being presented by the education in a kind of liberal culture, which has a very broad meaning here, meaning kind of open to everyone, so you can't impose your values, then it becomes very difficult to have any common values except for what's presented in materialist culture, which in the end, especially in times where you have greater and greater division between rich and poor, is guaranteed to give you violence, it seems to me. So, you know, having a real culture that has other components than consumer goods is vital to being able to prevent this kind of thing.
And another sort of significant component to this disorder has been the role of, once again, social media, BlackBerry messaging services, Facebook. People were communicating via Twitter, you know, where to go loot. You know, in the right. past few years, we've seen the Arab Spring, where these social networks were used to confront a oppressive regime. Here they're being used to organize mass disorder. So there's been some talk in Britain in the future of shutting down such services during this kind of disorder. I don't know if that's something that would ever be allowed in the United States because of that troublesome First Amendment, but they certainly can do it in Britain because they don't have a constitution. And the other, another interesting component of this is what happens from this point on. The police are using the plethora of security cameras, closed-circuit security networks, and face recognition software now to track down people who were involved in the disorder and start making arrests.
I mean, this is where the anti-terrorism activity and anti-crime activity come together, it seems to me. Britain has an extensive network of CCTV.
Big Brother is watching.
Big Brother is watching all the time, everywhere. And so, you know, and now you see all these people with their hoodies and their masks. And so they knew that this was going to be out there, but they're being identified by their outfits. And
well, it certainly is a brave new world here that we're confronting. I don't know what Orwell would have to say about it. Probably something we'd have trouble understanding. At any rate, we're going to have to break now. We've been meeting with, we've been talking with Karen Sue Smith, Drew Christensen. I'm Kevin Clark. Thanks for visiting us at americamagazine.org.